From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Is too much of a good thing bad? Fareed Zakaria thinks so when it comes to democracy. In a new book, this global big thinker and editor of Newsweek International argues that too much democracy in the wrong places can mean the death of liberty. At a time when America is loudly exporting democracy to Iraq, it's an argument worth hearing out tonight on Point. Democracy, liberty, and the future of freedom. We begin with an anti-American outburst in Iraq. Thousands of demonstrators left Friday prayers today in Baghdad mosques, chanting anti-American slogans and calling for a new Islamic state. Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. I asked him to describe what happened in Baghdad today and what's behind the dark mood.
Well, this is the second day of prayer since the regime fell, and it's the first time things have turned ugly here since the American troops came into the city. There's been a marked change in attitude from the first days when people were skeptical to now when they're angry. What we saw today was imams giving speeches at mosques. This happened at several mosques around town, saying if the Americans think they're going to stay, they have another thing coming. Those were followed by several protests around the city, the largest of which was about 10,000 people. They were chanting, down with Saddam, down with America, yes to an Islamic state, and carrying anti-American banners and pro-Islamic state banners.
Thanasi, what's going on here? This is clearly not the path to a new order that Washington has in mind, but does Washington have control of the situation?
I would say control on the ground is rather tenuous here, and I would also say that perhaps American war planners underestimated how quickly people would grow impatient, and they might also have underestimated how strong the desire for an indigenous Iraqi government, and at that, a religious government, is here in the capital. I've spoken with a lot of people over the last couple of days, including several Shia imams, and the desire to see an Iranian-style religious government runs deep. There are some distinctions in that people want a religious government that is ecumenical in that it would include Sunni Muslims. They also envision a state in which there would be a place for Iraq's Christian minority. However, what they want and what they want quickly is their vision of a democratic state, which is a religious state. There are about 12 Shia imams who are considered the leaders of the Shia community here, which is more than two-thirds of the country, and they believe they have the leadership they like already in place.
Thanasi, looking on from afar, it would seem that very shortly after the end of heavy fighting here, the U.S. is in a pretty tough situation. On the one hand, people are saying, United States, you have to bring order. On the other hand, they're saying, get out of here.
The paradox is not quite as complicated as it seems. When you actually talk to people in detail, what they want is for America to fix, in their opinion, to fix what it broke and maybe improve things a little beyond where they were when the regime left. And then they want America to leave. So right now, it's very simple. People don't have power. They don't have phones. They don't have food. They don't have salaries. These were all things they had under Saddam Hussein. And even this great majority that did not like that regime thinks, at the very least, their life should be at the level it was before this war started. And it still isn't.
The Iraqi exile opposition leader Ahmed Chalabi, who has been favored by the U.S. Pentagon, made his first appearance in Baghdad today. I understand he talked to journalists at a posh Baghdad country club. Is this a man with a constituency in Baghdad? Could he be a response to the imams in the mosques or not?
I think he is a can of worms. His club is in Mansour, which is a neighborhood, a rich neighborhood in Baghdad, which is actually one in which there were a lot of Saddam Hussein sightings during the war. He is viewed with suspicion by many of the locals here. He's not spent any time in the country in the last decade. And although he's brought with him an entourage and there are people grouped outside this country club, he's turned into his headquarters, there are a lot more people who are suspicious of his desire to come in here. They see him as a proxy for the Americans. They see him as someone who is too wealthy and too out of touch to represent Iraqis. And frankly, the sentiment I've seen here does not bode well for him either.
So does that leave any power center other than Islamic power centers?
That's the million-dollar question right now in Baghdad, and I think some people are hopeful that other leaders will emerge. You see within the intellectual class that was not exiled, so far no one has emerged as a spokesperson. There are figures out there, university professors, people who quietly voiced support for reform during Saddam Hussein's regime without actually openly advocating against it, and that's why they were allowed to stay in the country and continue to speak. Some of these leaders might emerge, but the sense in speaking with them is they don't want to be linked to this U.S. force that's here. I think the biggest challenge the Americans have right now is creating some sort of bridge, some sort of indigenous bridge structure to run the country that at the same time doesn't suffer for having been approved by the U.S. military.
And meanwhile, is there evidence that U.S. forces are bringing back some of the infrastructure required for a return to normal life there?
So far, it's hard to see, but I spoke with the Marines today. They have gotten 7 power substations back online. The power grid here is repaired, and they should have electricity online within days. They've already managed to return electricity in scattered places for a few hours at a time, but they believe they have the capability to light up the city quickly. They also believe the water treatment plants and water pumping stations will be fully functional in a matter of days. They're bringing a cellular phone network by the end of the week to give to emergency personnel, so at least they will be able to communicate amongst themselves and police, ambulances, and fire departments.
And what's your sense, Thanasi, given these chants today of no to America, leave our country, we want peace, can you imagine quantities of American soldiers still on the streets of Baghdad a month from now, 6 months from now?
Again, it's difficult to tell because you see American soldiers walking alone in the streets being greeted with I love you and thank you by passersby. So there still is a large constituency here that welcomes them and feels safer for the American presence. If Iraq heads in the direction that pleases Iraqis, I think they'll be willing to countenance the American presence for up to a year. I've asked this question explicitly of dozens of people, and that's exactly what they've said. So long as it doesn't feel like an occupation, the problem will come if life doesn't get better.
Thanasi Kambanis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. He spoke with me earlier from Baghdad. Big money, lobbyists, well-organized special interest groups, their overpowering force in America often skews this country's politics. In less established democracies, misuse of the ballot box itself can lead, perversely, to tyranny. Democracy is not always the answer, says our guest tonight, Fareed Zakaria, in his new book, The Future of Freedom. America is increasingly embracing a simple-minded populism that values popularity and openness as the key measures of legitimacy, he writes. The result is a deep imbalance in the American system, more democracy but less liberty. It may sound like heresy, but Fareed Zakaria claims it is critical to understand democracy's limits and its dangers. With Iraq's political reconstruction now in U.S. hands, we're listening. Could it be that democracy is not always the best medicine? Does this sound like wisdom, like insight, or like backsliding? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from New York by Fareed Zakaria, editor of Newsweek International and author of the new book, The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. Good evening and welcome, Fareed Zakaria.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for being with us. Fareed, we've heard you talking. We've read the book. You've got a provocative thesis, especially, as you well know, in an American context. But it sounds like you've seen just too much democracy. It's got your allergies up. What's the evidence? What's out there that's bothering you about the extent and the presentation, the implementation of democracy today, Fareed Zakaria?
Well, I started thinking about this when I was looking around the world in the 1990s and seeing this widespread rise of elections everywhere. And I initially, like everyone, was caught up in the enthusiasm of it and went to some of these countries and was really caught up in the fervor. And then I noticed if you went back a few years later, these regimes were just awful. They were abusing human rights, suppressing and oppressing minorities. And often it seemed as though this process was following a certain kind of pattern where the process of democracy would give rise in a place like Yugoslavia to ethnic nationalism because politicians would compete on the easiest tool they could find, which was to evoke nationalist feelings and anti-minority feelings. And all of this led me to sort of take a long and hard look at what we mean by democracy. My argument is not that democracy isn't a great thing. Of course it is. But what we mean by democracy in the West is really two sets of things. The elections, for sure, but also what I call the inner stuffing of democracy, the institutions that produce individual liberty, the rule of law, the separation of powers, constitutions and courts. And if you end up with elections without these things, then democracy is just an empty shell.
I want to dive into what you mean on each of those fronts about that kind of infrastructure that you say is necessary to keep democracy from eroding liberty. But before we go there, I just want to probe again at your fundamental attitude toward democracy. It is, of course, the bread and butter of American political life. And I read you writing that democracy has gone from being a form of government to a way of life. You write that as a critique. It could sound very welcome to some American ears. We read you complaining about culture being democratized, about economics being democratized. Is there something fundamentally unsettling to you or in your view, destructive about the populism that comes with expanding democracy? It was, of course, as you know, celebrated in the 90s.
I would put it this way. I am one of democracy's greatest fans. I would argue that, in fact, what I am its best fan, because I don't want it to be abused. I think democracy has always sustained itself and enriched itself by the fact that it was part of a complex system, that there were within that system institutions, traditions, and a civic culture that sustained it, and that those traditions are not necessarily themselves democratic. For example, the court system. I mean, the Supreme Court is 9 unelected men and women, probably the most powerful part of the American government, or the Federal Reserve Bank, or certain kinds of clubs and what Tocqueville used to call the intermediate associations that guide American life. So the point I'm making is that democracy always depended on being in balance with these things, these other undemocratic features. And if you end up with very few of these other stabilizers and only democracy and populism and polls, then yes, you are impoverishing the political and social life of the country. And you do have, in that sense, too much democracy.
So before we point fingers abroad, and you can make a critique of Yugoslavia or Uzbekistan, wherever you like, but what's your critique of the United States itself and the state of its balance of democracy and liberty, the health of the U.S. democracy?
Look, I think in comparison with the democracies abroad, particularly in the Third World, we're doing fantastically. And I make that point in the book that I'm simply casting an eye on America and asking, well, having cast judgments all over the world, what do I think of American democracy? I think American democracy has always sustained itself in large part, by these institutions that protect liberty. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights are at the heart of American democracy. I mean, after all, what does the Bill of Rights say? It says no matter what a democratically elected majority may say, you cannot abridge these rights of free speech.
But are you saying too much power in the United States is filtered down into the hands of little men and women, and it needs to be pulled back into the hands of an elite?
No, actually, the point I make about the way in which the American system has opened up, has democratized, is that it has produced the exact opposite of what it was trying to do. The paradox of American democracy is that in opening up the system, what you ended up doing was making it easily penetrated by special interest groups, by narrow, fanatical, dedicated minorities. Because when you create a system where congressmen and senators lose all the insulation from the public, it turns out the public is not really the ones influencing them. You don't write 10 faxes a day to your congressman, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? 25 lobbyists do, and 250 interest groups do. So you opened up the system. You got rid of the barriers in the late 1960s and 70s.
More democratic,
but
problems along with that.
But guess who took advantage? Small fanatical interest groups.
Fareed Zakaria, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We want to hear much more. We're talking tonight about the future of freedom and the notion that too much democracy may drive out liberty. Is there such a thing as too much democracy? Do you buy Fareed Zakaria's critique of America's iconic political export? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the future of freedom and the notion that too much democracy might drive out liberty. It's the thesis of a new book by Fareed Zakaria, editor of Newsweek International and author of The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. You can join the conversation. Is democracy without a commitment to liberty a recipe for tyranny? Are there things that some third world countries need before democracy? And what does Fareed Zakaria's analysis mean for Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Fareed Zakaria, you make this sharp distinction that I think in many American minds is not immediately obvious between democracy and liberty. We tend to lump them into one category, even into one definition. Pull those apart for us to help us understand the distinction you're drawing.
When we think about American democracy, we often think about everything it represents, but Americans often think that this is the most democratic country in the world. But among the major democracies, it's actually probably the least democratic. What do I mean by that? Well, at the center of American democracy is the Bill of Rights, that, as I say, says to people, no matter what the elected majority says, these rights are sacrosanct. You cannot do, it says to the majority, these kinds of things.
These are untouchable liberties.
Right. And these are liberties, in effect, cast in stone, no matter what the democratic process may want to do about them. The Supreme Court, probably the most powerful part of our government, the third most powerful branch, is 9 unelected men and women. The entire court system, for the most part, unelected men and women serving for life.
And you look at these as anchors of liberty in a sea of democracy, which can be chaotic sometimes. Are you saying that when democracy has been pushed abroad or picked up abroad in the last decade and more, it hasn't come with these guardrails, with these buffers?
Precisely. If you look at, I start the book in 324 AD because the development of Western liberty has taken a long time. And these institutions, the creation of the rule of law, constitutions, courts, took a long time. And when we go abroad and we foist on countries that do not have this developed tradition, just elections, we do them a disservice because they end up with elected dictatorships rather than democracy.
I think that's hard for many Americans to take on board, how you get it, an elected dictatorship. And you use the phrase illiberal democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that when you look at American democracy or Western democracy, what you're getting at the combination of two traditions. The first one, as I say, being the institutions of liberty, which is where the term liberal comes from, and the other is elections, so liberal democracy. But when you go abroad and you just find elections without that tradition, what you're getting is not liberal democracy, but illiberal democracy.
Give us some examples.
Well, pretty much throughout Central Asia and Africa, you have had elections that have yielded thugs who have then abused human rights, suppressed minorities. Africa has held probably 70 elections in the last decade. I don't think any of us would claim that most of the countries there are genuinely democratic. The most prominent example, in my view, is actually Russia. Boris Yeltsin and Putin, both freely and fairly elected, but if you examine the course they have followed, they have fired regional governors they did not like. They have intimidated a once free media into total submission. They have actually ordered the execution of some politicians they disagreed with. The whole experience of Russia has pointed out, I think, how easy it is for an elected leader with popular support to subvert liberty. Venezuela's Chavez is another example, but perhaps less important one.
You know, Fareed, as I hear you saying this, boy, it's funny times that we live in. We started this week talking with Neil Ferguson, who reviewed your book just last week, of course, in the New York Times. And his book, of course, his book is Empire. He's saying, hey, bring back many of the mechanisms of the British Empire. Now, here we are at the week's end, and you're saying, whoa, let's put the brakes on democracy. What's happening here? Is this an American kind of freak out at the rest of the world getting a taste of what we've had for a long time? Is there really an alternative to these countries wading into democratic waters and learning this? Can we put the whole world in a kind of receivership until they're ready, mature, whatever it is for democracy? What are you suggesting?
You know, I think you've touched on something. What we have found in the last 10 or 15 years is that while there's no debate left about whether democracy is the best form of government, of course it is, liberal democracy. Really, there is an end of history in the sense that Francis Fukuyama meant it. But getting there is proving to be damn difficult. It's proving much more difficult than people realized. And what we're finding is that many societies are really not nations. They're failed states. They're chaotic. In those circumstances, you have to ask yourself, what exactly do you need? And you need order. You need the establishment of government. And then you need the gradual creation of a kind of liberal democratic regime. And I think that's really the impulse. It's not that you want your empire or that you don't want democracy or anything like that. It's just that we're finding, democracy is not like macaroni and cheese. You don't have it all in the box. You add water and pay presto, it happens.
And you can't just glop it on the plate. You know, but Fareed, you sound so smart and reasonable, but yet within this is this kind of notion of something that sounds like perpetual tutelage, of greater and lesser nations. And they will learn over many years. But who guides and how do you guard against exploitation if you don't embrace democracy?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and I don't have a simple answer for it. But I will point out to you that if you look at the only successful model in the last 35 years of a movement of non-Western countries toward liberal democracy, they come mostly from places that were ruled by dictatorships. Then these were, East Asian countries like Taiwan, South Korea.
You dropped out for a second, but you said dictatorships there.
Right. They were dictatorships, countries like Taiwan, South Korea.
And they weren't pretty. I mean, I saw them firsthand, and there were a lot of heavy batons and prison sentences and very rough treatment of citizens of those countries.
Absolutely. I mean, Pinochet's Chile, it is a strange irony that it is Pinochet's Chile that established order, then liberalized its economy, created a rule of law, and then finally, 20 years later, held elections. It is that country that is now the most fully established liberal democracy in Latin America. That's a judgment, by the way, nobody would disagree with.
But very hard to prescribe military dictatorship to people coming out of a country like, just for example, Iraq. Fareed Zakaria, stand by. A lot of people want to join our conversation. I want to welcome them in. Rick's calling from Boston. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Mr. Zakaria, first I wanted to tell you I've enjoyed hearing your commentary in other places, and I'm pleasantly surprised that you're on NPR tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I wonder whether or not some of what you're saying maybe catches people off guard a little bit, because it sounds as if you're almost suggesting that we shouldn't have democracy, and I don't think that you are. I took rather that you're saying to us that there's a danger really in radical majoritarianism, that democracy unbridled by without any break on it, without the Bill of Rights and other institutions, which are, by your term, undemocratic, put some break and prevent the majority from running amok.
You're exactly right. And what I'm trying to remind people is that those institutions are crucial to the creation of genuine democracy, and that's the hard part, in a sense. Anyone can hold an election in, let's say, some developing country. You know, that's the easiest part of it. The hard question is, how do you create the rule of law? How do you create a Bill of Rights? And so when we look at a country like Iraq, of course I'm not advocating that there should be a dictatorship, but what I'm saying is, let's sequence this right. Let's spend some time figuring out how we put in place these institutions before we begin the raw political contest that we know is going to have a certain dynamic to it, and it'll make politicians start radicalizing the political atmosphere with calls to Islamic fundamentalism or tribal allegiance and all that. Before we get to that, let's first enshrine some individual rights.
But Rick, let me ask you, do you think that Iraqis are ready to have America come in, or anyone come in, and prescribe some kind of interim undemocratic transition?
Well, I'm not, obviously I don't know the answer to the question. And it's one of the other, this to me leads to the a question, and I think, Mr. Zakaria, again, you're maybe well qualified to speak to this. I wondered whether or not you thought in an Islamic culture, in an Islamic-dominated country, whether or not it is permissive enough of the kind of tolerance, because really underlying the liberty is a certain tolerance. You have to let the other people, somebody else rub you the wrong way sometimes.
Kind of live and let live.
Well, there has to be some of that. It's part of having our Constitution and the Bill of
Rights. Rick, let us pick that up. It's a great question. Fareed Zakaria, what does this suggest about democracy and Islam, which, of course, gets very enmeshed with the political life of any culture where it's dominant?
Sure. I spend some time on this in the book. I think there is nothing intrinsically in opposition between democracy and Islam. Look, at a practical matter, point out to you that Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world, is democratic. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all the second, third, and fourth largest Muslim populations in the world have all had experiences with democracy. Turkey is a Islamic, is a Muslim country that's democratic. There are aspects of every religion that are antithetical to precisely what the gentleman was saying. You know, let's not forget the Christian Church has had its problems with being tolerant of differences, and religious wars went on for 300 or 400 years. The most important part of this is modernizing the society, modernizing the economy and the politics enough that human beings begin to view religion as a kind of template for spiritual guidance rather than day-to-day activity.
How do you accomplish that? I mean, the view has long been that, certainly in America, that if you don't have power in democratic hands, that there's no guarantee that the elites of any particular nation or society are going to push for the common good. And we've seen many examples throughout history where they have not. Democracy is supposed to be the counterweight to that.
Well, let's look at ethnically divided societies, religiously divided societies, Yugoslavia, Indonesia, places like it's worth pointing out that in those countries it is the authoritarian regimes that actually maintained a tradition of secularism, maintained a tradition of not fomenting and whipping up radical religious ethnic identities.
Well, great, but you're citing a couple of places. What about all those places that had undemocratic and even secular regimes, but that were exploitative, that were tyrannical, that were not progressive in any sense of the word, and still are not?
As I keep saying, I'm not advocating authoritarianism. What I'm saying is, let's recognize that democracy has this tendency because politicians are catering for votes in countries without strong traditions of civic association or large middle classes. Politicians aren't going to vote. Aren't going to try to garner votes on the basis of tax cuts or things like that. They're going to make raw appeals to nationalism, race, ethnicity, and so build into the system certain safeguards.
But you're talking about Chile, about South Korea, about Taiwan in times when they were very politically intolerant. And I guess my question is just, what is to give the people of those countries and outside countries, if they're involved, for example, the United States and Iraq right now, a guarantee that there's progress going on toward liberal democracy, toward a social structure beneficial to the entire country? In the absence of democracy, what guarantees that?
Well, let's look at those countries. There is no guarantee of anything, either in democracy or authoritarian regimes. But in those countries you were describing, year by year, decade by decade, you saw more individual rights, greater protections, greater legal protections, the rule of law being substantiated, economic reforms. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, if you're so sure of this, if you would ask a family, would they rather have lived in South Korea or Taiwan over the last 20 years versus any of the great people's democracies of Africa, or Central Asia? I mean, I think it's an easy question. I mean, in Taiwan, South Korea, places like that, what you saw was dramatic rises in living standards and dramatic rises in individual freedom.
Yeah, I'm not getting my point across. I guess great for them, lucky for them that after their suffocating period of political intolerance, they achieved those things.
But simply
having a heavy-handed government doesn't guarantee that.
Well, what guarantees it in a democracy? I mean, there are no guarantees either way. What I'm telling you is a certain sequence of constitutionalism, rule of law, economic reform first, followed by democracy, seems to have worked. The opposite seems to have worked nowhere. That is to say, holding elections and just hoping everything will go all right doesn't seem to have worked. Maybe we should learn something from that.
Adil's calling from Boston. Hi, Adil. You're on the air.
It's a really nice discussion you guys are having. I'm actually not really. I really don't know much about you, but I think it's a really interesting discussion. And I just wanted to. We've been talking about democracy, and I was just wondering if there's certain key factors that you would look at. I mean, is it a one size fits all across different nations? I mean, you've got things like culture, you've got education of that population. Would it vary by depending on which country you're in?
A very good question. I mean, basically, I am not a big fan of cultural arguments. I don't think any particular people are genetically either predisposed or better or worse at democracy. But I do think that, again, historically, when you look at it, the society needs to have developed to a certain point. I have a long section in my book describing the relationship between the size of a middle class and having a middle class society and democracy. And it turns out in almost every successful transition to democracy in the last 40 or 50 years, you have needed to have the beginnings of a middle class society. Again, this is not an argument that says it can't happen at all.
You even suggest a per capita income level of around $6,000, if I understand correctly.
Right. I mean, what I say is there's a range of about $3,000 to $6,000 if you're on the higher end. Obviously, it's better. And the reason for this is what needs to happen for democracy to really work and to be meaningful is that the society needs to have been modernized. It needs to have been developed. You need the creation of civic life and civil society. Without that, you know, all you get is the election, and it's one man, one vote, one time sometimes.
But with this, it seems to me that it puts America in the role, if it's going to be out there promoting something, of almost a necessarily imperial role, because it's not coming saying here's democracy. If it's coming and saying here's Pinochet for you, here's Chun Doo-hwan for you, here's authoritarian rule for you until you're ready for more. Isn't that a difficult torch to bear around the globe?
It is a difficult one if it were the one you're describing. It's not quite that. I mean, if you look at the way we have gone about in the last 5 years correcting some of the errors of the early 90s, it's actually quite encouraging. In East Timor, we insisted on a two-year transition before they would move to any kind of elections. In Cambodia, it's actually been 5 years. In Kosovo and Bosnia, the UN is still in charge. In Afghanistan, we're again delaying the process of moving to full multi-party elections. Nobody's calling it imperialism. These countries realize they need to develop the institutions.
Fareed Zakaria, stand by. We've got to take a break. We're talking about the future of freedom and the notion that too much democracy may drive out liberty. You can join the conversation. Is this heresy? Do you put more trust in the people than Fareed Zakaria? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
In Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the future of freedom and the notion that too much democracy may drive out liberty. My guest is Fareed Zakaria. His new book is The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. You've been listening. What do you think? Has even America become too democratic for its own good? Can you see what Fareed Zakaria is talking about? Does this critique sound like a defense of liberty or a surrender of democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Bernie's calling from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. If I could make a few quick points and then
sure.
Hit Iraq, the key issue of the day.
Yes, please.
I think that the guest is correct that democracy is no guarantee of liberty. I'd bring as an example the war on drugs, and I'd say that the Constitution and Bill of Rights have been eroded over many decades. I think the problem in America is that we have special interests that are controlling our government. It isn't how often you write or fax your representatives or so-called representatives. It's how much you contribute. Mm-hmm. And we also have a very uninformed populace. But as far as foreign policy goes, the guest had commented on Chile. There was a democratically elected leader in Chile in the early 1970s, Salvador mm-hmm. Allende, that our government deposed. We got rid of him. We didn't like his policies. They weren't good for American businesses.
And what do you take from that, Bernie?
I take from that that and many other examples, Iran, et cetera, that our government is, despite what most of us are taught in school, is not interested in democracy. Our government is interested in power politics, interested in controlling resources, et cetera. And I hate to say that. It's just the fact of life.
So are you saying let's not lose sleep over this? This isn't what Washington's pushing anyway?
Well, what I'm saying is that I think what's happening now in Iraq is that an excuse is being brought forward to try to convince people that it's in the best interest of the Iraqi people for them not to control their own fate. And I think what we need to do is we need to stop all this pretense about wanting democracy. I mean, we support many, many countries around the world, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, that have no interest in democracy. You know, our interests are not democracy. And basically, to talk about people like, you know, East Timor being ready for democracy, East Timor was victimized by Indonesia for years with U.S. military support.
But what are you prescribing for Iraq here, Bernie?
I'm prescribing that we get out of there and let those people control their own fate. It's against international law. We were there in the first place, and we're there for the oil, pure and simple.
Okay, thanks for your call. Fareed Zakaria.
I think it's fair to say that America has supported dictatorships through its history, and particularly during the Cold War, we supported a number of rather unsavory regimes because they were anti-communist. But I think for the last 20 years, it's actually an unfair rap. That is to say, America has by and large tried to press regimes around the world for more human rights, more democracy. Think about, as I was saying, you look at East Asia, and in all those cases, Taiwan, South Korea, places like that, it was American pressure that was quite important in forcing political liberalization there. Of course, there was a middle class, and of course, the lion's share of the pressure came internally. The one exception, by the way, was the Middle East. The Middle East has been the great exception in American foreign policy, and it has been because of oil. We've been too scared to upset the balance, and we were too fearful of the unknown.
So now here we are with the big one, Iraq, and it's in America's lap. What's your prescription, Fareed Zakaria?
Well, I believe that if we just abandon it, we will not produce democracy or liberty or anything other than chaos and the rule of another strong man. So I don't see how that helps the Iraqi people. I believe what we should do is stay in there for a protracted period of time, internationalize it so that it is not American occupation, so that it is, whether it's the UN or another multilateral organization, I don't care. But it is a multilateral effort of international political and economic assistance, the kind you have in Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor, Cambodia, Mozambique, Angola. No one's calling those colonialism. I think people understand that the motive here is to try to help the maturation of a political process.
And you write about, you say that when the U.S. intervenes to overthrow rogue regimes, that should be at least a five-year period of transition. How on earth do you have a five-year period without this looking like a new sort of British mandate?
Well, look, in most of the countries I described, you've either had no elections or you've had elections, but the elected officials don't have complete power, and so you've retained certain core functions that are still being done by international administrators in Kosovo, in Bosnia, and places like that.
But I guess what I keep coming back to is if you don't hold up democracy, which puts faith in the people and therefore is seen as having a kind of authority and justification in its own right, then what is the operative authority here? We're going to show you what to do from Washington because we know best the way to get to the best outcome? Is it the UN that's just going to lay it down for Iraq? What about the intrinsic rights of the Iraqi people?
Well, are they going to be guaranteed by just having one election and leaving and then hoping for the best? I suppose, you know, that would be one view. My argument is that democracy is a more complicated thing and that if you really want to try and achieve it and build it, it's going to take some time. It's not something that happens overnight. And the international community does have a certain legitimacy. It is working on these in all the countries I mentioned.
So you're saying turn it over to the UN and then what? Flesh out the picture, the process for us a little bit.
Sure. Well, what you do is for a few years, you create a wide group of Iraqis, a body like the Loya Jirga in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. a kind of national town council or several of them, and you start serious discussions about the writing of a constitution, the issue of power sharing. How much power do you provide the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds? You know, how do you create checks and balances within the system? What kind of court system? What kind of it? You see, you need to figure all these things out, the system of government, before you get to who's going to rule. Because once you decide who's going to rule, the ruler has no interest in limiting the power of the state, in protecting individual rights. He says, trust me.
If you make the line from the ballot box to all that power too direct.
Well, if you think about it, it's much easier to get a fair political system when the people who are making these decisions don't know whether they are going to be the rulers or the ruled.
Mm-hmm.
You see, once you figure that question out, the rulers suddenly lose interest in the rule of law.
So John Rawls rules here. We've just got a couple minutes left. Fareed, bring us a brilliant
connection, by the way. I've never yet had somebody on radio or television make the connection, but that is exact. It's a version of Rawls's veil.
Mm-hmm. Bring us back to the United States for a moment, because you've been mild tonight, but in the book you're actually fairly nearly apocalyptic on it. You're talking about Western democracy being like a supernova. You know, we're seeing the light of it years later, but in fact it's already hollowed out. What is the sickness that you seem to see in the American democracy, and what's the fix?
When Tocqueville came here, one of the things that he was struck by was that American democracy was sustained by a whole set of intermediate institutions, he called them, between the state and the family, political parties, church associations, choral societies, bowling leagues. And what's happening because of...
Well, not so many bowling leagues maybe in Tocqueville's day, but maybe a few, I don't know.
Well, the equivalent of bowling
right.
leagues. What's happening is, because of a kind of simple-minded populism, many of these organizations are being hollowed out. This is something Robert Putnam, by the way, describes in beautiful and graphic detail in his book Bowling Alone. Mm-hmm. And I argue that this produces a kind of political dysfunction in the culture, where you get the rise of an unchecked populism, and most importantly, you get the rise of special interests and minority groups dominating political discourse.
And why are they more powerful in this circumstance?
Because you've lost the intermediating organizations. You've lost all the buffers. You've lost the political parties. You see, these organizations used to channel aspirations. Let me give you an example. A political party was a wonderful example of this, because whatever narrow groups existed, they had to meet within the political party, the Democratic Party and the Republican, and the unions had some views and big business had some, but it had to all be worked out to create a common platform.
Now it's a free fire zone and the big guns win. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time, but it's been great having you, Fareed Zakaria. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
Fareed Zakaria joined us from New York. He's editor of Newsweek International and author of The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a satirical look at this week's phone call between President George W. Bush and Jacques Chirac. This is On Point. In an effort to mend relations, French President Jacques Chirac spoke with President Bush on Tuesday for the first time since the beginning of February and the furious debate over war with Iraq. In the 20-minute phone conversation, Chirac promised to be pragmatic in supporting the rebuilding of Iraq. Financial Times columnist Gerard Baker didn't get to actually listen in on the conversation, but he says he knows how it went.
French President Jacques Chirac called President Bush this week for the first time since diplomatic negotiations to avoid war in Iraq collapsed 2 months ago. By chance, the transcript of the conversation has fallen into my hands, and here it is. George, you have reached the offices of the Government of Free Iraq. For Ahmed Moneybags Chalabi, press 1. For J. Newcomb Garner, press 2. For Jim Jihad Woolsey, press 3. George? To listen to this message in French, surrender immediately. George? Ha ha, just having a little fun there, Jack. Ah, yes, of course. Very droll, Mr. President. George, we have not spoken for a while, but I wanted to call and with great sincerity and affection congratulate you on the most impressive efforts of the U.S. war machine in the recent conflict in Iraq. Of course, I want you to know that whatever our differences in diplomacy, we in France were right behind you in your struggle against the brutal dictatorship, which is now thankfully no more. When we saw the tide of victory turn in your favor a week ago, we immediately decided to support your efforts unconditionally. And in the spirit of 1789, the whole of France rejoiced in the dethroning of the tyrannical monster of Baghdad. But it is extremely important, George, for us all to be clear that this entire issue has been a matter of principle. I hope you understand. We live in a world now dominated by the hyperpuissance, an existential threat to the global system we've worked so hard to create. The what, Jack? All we've been seeking to do, and in a purely political sense, what we still try to do is to create an alternative pole, a unipolar world, un monde unipolaire. It is by its very nature an unbalanced world, a world tilted dangerously towards risk, a world pregnant with the possibility of instability, a world of imminent peril, a world in permanent crisis, in short, a world in which France is irrelevant. Right. We, and trust me, I speak for the whole of Europe here, and indeed the whole of the civilized world, Russia, China, Syria, even the impudent governments of Eastern Europe, we are troubled by the scenes of chaos and anarchy in Iraq. I was saying to my good friend Robert Mugabe only today that it's obscene that anyone should be allowed to plunder the heritage of an oppressed people. I wept, frankly, George, when I saw the elegant statuary in so many of Iraq's public squares callously pulled to pieces by the brutish crowds. But I do not wish to dwell on the past, George, even though there are many wrongs to be put right. I'm willing to forgive, to move on in a spirit of generosity. I want now to talk, if I may, about the future. I believe that the time for principled quarreling is over, that the time has come to be pragmatic. In that regard, I was curious. You haven't by any chance found any records relating to any export transactions of French companies and nationalized entities in the various palaces of that despot, have you? I think, as a matter of fact, we have, you know, something about weapons. You will understand, of course, that these are transactions that were entered into a long time ago that have no bearing on the current policies of this government. They are, as it were, ancient history, the forgotten mysteries of Babylon. On the other hand, George, as we made clear last week at the Group of Eight Finance Ministers meeting, we must examine with rigor this thorny issue of Iraq's debt. You must understand that these contractual obligations that France entered into in good faith must be observed with the full force of international law. It would be an absolute breach of the free market principles we in France hold so dear if people were simply able to walk away from their obligations. But I thought you just said past contracts were ancient history, Jack. Ah, George, we're trying to be pragmatic now. We're trying to be pragmatic. We have no idée fixe, George. We're trying to look to the future, our common future. Now, as a gesture of this spirit of cooperation, I can tell you that we will not insist at this point that France, I mean the United Nations, should take full responsibility for the administration of Iraq. We have no wish for our soldiers to be shot at by angry Iraqis. We think it only right that you and our treacherous British allies take on that important and rewarding role. But after that, when things look as though they might be successful, it is vital for the legitimacy of the new government that it be given the full imprimatur of the Security Council. That is all we ask. Jack, I sure appreciate this. We're ready to move on, too. In fact, we're getting ready to move on to Damascus. But we don't want to have to go through this messy UN business again. Any chance we might short-circuit the diplomacy with your help? Bien sûr, Georges. I'll have Dominique get Saddam out of there tonight. Salut.
Gerard Baker is a columnist with the Financial Times. He lives in Washington, D.C. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.